Well, ladies and gentlemen, I'm welcoming back to the Solaria Report a man who needs no introduction, Franklin Sanders of the Money Changer. We're going to talk about precious metals, but also talk about all the different things that are going on. So this is going to be an integrated picture of the markets, the financial and commodities markets, but then the reinvention of everything, if you will. So Franklin, welcome back to the Solaria Report.
Well, it's great to be here.
Okay, let's start. U.S. dollar, where are we going?
Well, if you look at that U.S. dollar chart, you can see that there's a roughly two-year-long megaphone or broadening top. And that might have been a consolidation and continuation pattern, or it might have been a top. And it frequently is a top. And what you'll see has happened is that it broke down after the high early this year. It broke down, it made a head and shoulders, that's that green line on there is the neckline. Then it broke down out of that, and it came all the way back to the low from May 2016. And the significant thing here is that it broke that low. That is our clue that this is a top. This is a top and not a continuation pattern. And it should go further down. So the only problem with that is, of course, as you know, that currency rates are all manipulated, the currency exchange rates. I mean, central banks commonly manipulate their rates. There doesn't seem to be any rational reason for why the Fed would want the dollar to drop. But then who says that the Fed is rational anyway?
Oh, but I think the executive branch would love to see the dollar drop.
That's probably true.
Right.
That's probably true. It is not true. The rationalization of it for it is not true that it makes U.S. dollar makes U.S. exports more competitive, because what happens is it just winds up with a spiral of competitive devaluations like it did during the Great Depression. So it's not true, but it's one of those nostrums that the people in charge follow. So that may be the rate. That may be the reason to account for it. What makes me more nervous is wondering if there's not some deeper cause, some bigger disease that we're not seeing within the dollar. And certainly, there are all sorts of noises being made by Russia and China that attack dollar hegemony around the world. And the dollar's status as a reserve currency is plainly one of the greatest strengths of the United States, other than its military. And of course, the military is used to enforce the dollar hegemony. So those, obviously the Chinese don't want that. And I was very much intrigued to see this new contract in Shanghai for oil that is soluble either in Chinese yuan or in gold.
Right.
And that is conceptually, that is an enormous step. Whether
right.
it actually catches on in practice yet is another thing. But the idea that that they could take, first of all, it raises the yuan to a status of an international trade currency.
Right.
If oil is being traded in that, and it's a direct attack on the dollar's sort of monopoly on pricing oil. And then if it offers also an alternative payment in gold, how can anybody resist it? I mean,
it's
a fabulous idea. So from their standpoint. So all those things together seem to say, plus the pattern that we see that looks like a top, all that together seems to say that the dollar's in for a pretty big fall. When I say pretty big fall, you remember this started about 80 on the dollar index, and you're looking today about 92 and a half, something like that. So that's a long ways to fall, ways to fall. So, and that of course has implications for gold and silver, because to some extent they are the reciprocal of gold, of the dollar index and other fiat currencies. So the more trouble the dollar has, the better it is for silver and gold.
Right. Right. Although I thought that, you know, I was waiting to see if the index would break the 92 line. Because to me, that's a very important technical support line. And it, you know, it went down, but then it's popped back up. And if you look at the various things that are happening between the U.S. and Russia and U.S. and North Korea, to me, a lot of that has to do with supporting that 92 line. So,
well, it may do, but then the other side of that is that the dollar has been sinking basically since the first of the year.
And correct.
Very much accelerated in the last few months. So regardless whether it's going to go down long term or not, it's time for a relief rally, you know, some kind of reaction up. So we'll have to see how far this carries. Can it get through 94 or not? So
And I would just point out, you've got at this point four, and although the president just put up one person for the Fed, but you know, basically you've got three or four vacancies at the Fed.
Yeah.
And the executive branch now has the ability to stack it with people who will take it wherever they want to go. So if they want a weak dollar, they can stack it with the people who will support that kind of policy.
Well, true. And, you know, the question arises, you and I have talked about this, why did Stanley Fischer leave?
So I just have to bring this up. I don't know if you noticed, but I decided when he resigned, I said, okay, that is very big for Stanley. You know, because generally when you're in Washington and you're a woman and you get put in a position like Yellen, they put a ringer quietly underneath you and then tell everybody, look, Fischer's really running things, you know, go through him.
Yeah.
So in a funny kind of way, Fischer's more important or bigger than Yellen in terms of the real flows.
Yes.
So, and Fischer's always been that kind of inside baseball player. So for Fischer to walk off before the end of the term, now he did it at the Bank of Israel, so this is not the first time he's walked off in the middle of the term, but for him to walk off in the middle of the term, you know, looks like a cut and run. And so I went to look at his resignation letter.
Yeah.
And it was very interesting because there was a line across the middle of it, and either he had folded and they hadn't fixed that before they put it up, or they had cut out a paragraph. I figure he probably folded it. But here's the thing. The reason I wanted to look at it was normally when you resign, you give 2-week notice or 4-week notice. But he gave an odd week number notice with the resignation going effective on October 13th, 2017. Now, October 13th is a Friday the 13th. And the history of superstition around Friday the 13th began in October 13th, a Friday. It was 1307 when the Vatican slaughtered the Templars. Now, I wouldn't bring that up except for the people who run these things, you know, care about symbology like that.
Yeah.
You know, they do numerology. They do. If you go look at important events or important resignations, you know, you will see a remarkable coincidence in terms of numerology. So when Stanley Fischer resigned on Friday, October 13th, I just said, oh, my God. So I'm waiting to see what it means. I don't know. But, I think it's a sign of somebody wanting to get out.
Yeah, well, that certainly is the way it looked, isn't it?
Right.
So that's kind of that's a little nerve-wracking. So
yes.
If that's the case, then that's just one little clue that says the dollar has bigger problems. So I don't know. Anyway, I think there's things are piling up,
right?
And that's scary for the dollar. There are a lot of things.
Right.
So okay, well. Let's go on to gold just a minute. And these are the charts that I'm offering today are all sort of big picture charts, longer term charts, because I think right now that's what's more important. It's more important to focus on the bigger context, the longer-term context, than it is just the day-to-day moves, although, of course, they're interesting too. But if you look at this gold chart, you see that there was a low in December 2015, and that low marked the end of the decline that began in August 2011. That diagonal red line at the top of the chart is the downtrend line from 2011. And you see the uptrend line was validated in December of 2016, and then it traveled up. Well, first of all, there's a big rally from December 2015 to July of 2016. Then there was a decline, a reaction, and that came back and validated that uptrend line. And then you traded back up to the downtrend line from 2011. Now, you have to realize that months and months ago, silver already crossed its downtrend line from 2011. But right. We were waiting for gold to do that. Gold crossed the 200-day moving average, that's that wavy red line on your chart, back in April, and zigzagged across it, and then finally in July crossed above it, and then crossed above the downtrend line from 2011, ran up to 1362, and then it has traded back to the 50-day moving average, and the 50-day moving average is a very common target for a market correction when a market is trending upwards. So right. What you've got is a momentous break, a proof, you know, this increasing proof with higher highs and lower lows. Right. You've got this big triangle, even-sided triangle formation that gold has broken out of. And now it's touched back after the first breakout. So our next goal is to get through 1380. And once gold does that, then it'll run. And the next big target will be the breakdown from 2013, which was about 1550. So this is, right. I think that's what you see unrolling right here. So it's a very, very, very bullish outlook for gold.
I wanted to mention, I was just in Colorado at a conference on cryptocurrencies, and essentially a lot of people who've been associated with sort of liberty and freedom were invited. So you had Ron Paul, you had Dennis Kucinich, you had Peter Schiff. I was there. So it was quite an interesting discussion. And one of the things that was very easy to see, if you understood sort of multiple markets, basically the people who've been buying cryptocurrency, if cryptocurrencies weren't attracting them in, they'd be buying coins.
That's no question.
And, you know, I sort of spent a lot of time going through the detail on that. Harry Blaser and I are going to do a report about it because he was there. And so we'll publish that sometime in the next 30 days. But here's basically what I saw. At one point, I was up on a panel with Dennis Kucinich and Patrick Byrne from Overstock, and everyone was talking about how they hate the Fed and, you know, when was the Fed going to come after this? And I said, why would the Fed come after this? Do you know how hard it is to manage the precious metals market? And if you can get trillions of dollars to buy zeros and ones instead of gold or land, you know, it makes your life that much more, you know, wonderful.
Absolutely.
You know, I almost felt like I was watching GLD 2.0.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, a way to suck off demand up from physical gold.
Do you ever read the Land Report? The Land Report is the 100 largest owners of land in the United States.
No.
Since 2008, Franklin, their holdings have almost doubled.
Really?
Yeah. It's fascinating to read. And so, you know, if you were sitting here contemplating the ultimate possibility of an implosion of all fiat currencies, mm-hmm. you know, what would you be buying? You'd be buying coins, right? You'd be buying coins and bars and land.
Let me add an observation to that. The, you know, I watch the premiums in the gold and silver market, that is the amount over gold or silver that an item costs, because the changes in those premiums, even though they're very small, can offer a significant clue to what is going on in the market. And in this year, premiums on items that had never broken before, gold items and silver items, that had never broken before, have simply evaporated. And every wholesaler I talk to complains that he is being covered up with product. And then there are a few reports that I hear of people who come in and sell and say that they're going to put their money in Bitcoin. Not a lot, but a few, and that's certainly logical. So it appears that there has been a large liquidation of physical gold and silver, and right. One would guess, and it's just a guess, that it's gone into Bitcoin. The Bitcoin parabolic curve is not sustainable. It can go on for a while, but sooner or later, that's going to crash. The physical gold and silver markets show that somebody is selling. Now, the spot price is not going down, but the price of the premium of these items is going down. Even the American Eagle's broke.
Yeah, so I've gotten significant reports of depositories being reduced or banks closing their safe deposit operations because they have such a reduced demand. I think some of that is people just needing, you know, money for expenses. So part of it is squeeze on incomes, not that they're putting it someplace else. But I would imagine if it wasn't for those dynamics, whether you're selling it to buy food or you're selling it to speculate in cryptocurrencies, we would be seeing the price much, much higher.
Right. I would agree with that. Of course, the problem with that is there's no way we can measure it. All we can do is look at these reflections and say, well, that's probably what we're seeing.
Right. Okay, so I interrupted you again. Continue.
Well, I think I'd finished talking about gold. I'm just saying that's a very, very bullish chart. And that last arrow on the right that points to that 50-day moving average, gold might yet go down to that 2011 uptrend line. Say, might go down to 1280, but $20 difference here is not, considering the magnitude of the rise that you're looking for, which is at least to $8,000, $20 right. here is not a magnitude worth fooling about. So let's go to silver. I think I'd finished talking about gold. I'm just saying that's a very, very bullish chart. And that last arrow on the right that points to that to that 50-day moving average, gold might yet go down to that 2011 uptrend line. Say, might go down to 1280. But $20 difference here is not, considering the magnitude of the rise that you're looking for, which is at least to $8,000, $20 right. here is not a magnitude worth fooling about.
Right. Okay, so I interrupted you again. Continue.
Well, I think I'd finished talking about gold. I'm just saying that's a very, very bullish chart. And that last arrow on the right that points to that, to that 50-day moving average, gold might yet go down to that 2011 uptrend line. Say, might go down to 1280, but $20 difference here is not, considering the magnitude of the rise that you're looking for, which is at least to $8,000, $20 right. here is not a magnitude worth fooling about. So right. let's go to silver. There's somewhat the same pattern in silver as in gold. There was a low in 2015, and there's been an uptrend since then. The uptrend, you know, validated by another low at the end of December of 2016. You got a big strong rise too in 2016, and silver has made this even-sided triangle outlined by green. Made a false breakdown back in July, that was the 10th of July, where there was a sudden one-day spike down to, it says 1434, I never saw it there, but That's what my chart says. And from there, that's a typical false breakdown. It's a trap. And it traded right square back up through the nose of the triangle and broke out of the triangle and headed higher. But it was stopped about 18, below 1850 or around 1850, which is the next next target that we've got. So it's basically doing the same thing gold does, but whenever you look at a silver chart, you expect to see more extremes. You expect to see wild things like that false breakdown. Silver just more volatile. It's just a smaller market. But it's above the downtrend line from 2011. It broke through that last year, and it's never gone back under it. It's above the uptrend line from December of 2015. It's broken out of an even-sided triangle to the upside. And there's just, as this chart stands right now, there's just no pain in it. You know, I mean, it looks like all it's got to do is get through 1866, which was the last high, and then it'll head for about 2130. So, again, silver looks really, really strong. But as with gold, the premiums on silver items have all collapsed. Even the gold American Eagles have lost a good bit of their premium. I'd like to look, too, at the gold-silver ratio. That's the fourth chart. And you see there's an uptrend. There was an uptrend from April 2011, the last time that the gold-silver ratio made a low about 32-1. And that traded up all the way, call it, to 84 in March of 2016. And then you can see that it just collapsed, and that is what I think is the first leg down where I've got that one down there. Then you've got a corrective sideways trading that breaks out and goes up to 79. The numbers on this chart are a little bit exaggerated, but that's okay. It gives us the pattern anyway. And now it's retreated and formed a downtrend. And the next leg down is going to be a big one. Third leg down is what's starting, and it should be a very, very big one, and should carry to someplace like 50. It's about 75 now, unless, of course, it negates that by going up through 79. But for right now, it looks like the gold-silver ratio is dropping, as it should drop if gold and silver intend to rise.
Right.
And the last chart I have is Dow Industrials. They made a megaphone or broadening top formation and threw over the top of that, but then that throw over failed. And this is kind of characteristic of topping markets. And then it broke out again in a real sharp wedge-shaped rally, and that looks like it's dribbling out now. So I don't know. I mean, could it go to 23,000? Oh, sure. Yeah, could. But this chart today is numbered. So I think that's a place to be pretty defensive.
Here's the pretty interesting thing. I don't know if I send you the chart on the Fortune 500 revenues?
Remind me what it looked like.
So from 1955 to 1995, the Fortune 500 revenues grew approximately in alignment and at the same pace as the U.S. GNP. And then in 1995, the Fortune 500 revenues exploded and grew to a point where today they're up more than double for the period from 1955. So the GNP is up 4,000+% and the Fortune 500 revenues are up 88,500%.
Wow.
So significantly more than double. And if you look this year, for example, at all markets, so you look at precious metals, you look at securities, and you look at stocks, they've significantly outperformed the GNP. So every year, your liquid traded either securities or commodities outperform the GNP. And that's an enormous sucking sound out of the real economy into those mechanisms. Now, precious metals is a relatively tiny market, but the stock and bond market, and the stock market's now up to 83 trillion plus. Of course, we've got, and then the fixed income markets say they're at about 140, 150 trillion. And for those to consistently outperform the real economy means you need a giant sucking sound. Well, that giant sucking sound has traditionally been engineered by governments borrowing money and then giving contracts, you know, or purchases to those Fortune 500 companies. So, and, you know, there are many mechanisms, but basically that rise has floated with the rise of debt on sovereign governments. And so what you see when you look at the chart for 2016-2017 is it's starting to drop down, and you can tell there's a war going on to get it back up. So the question is, you know, where's the tornado going to harvest next? And so you go back to the stock market and you say, if the rise of this has been floated by 19 trillion of missing money and, you know, the budget being engineered to run everything through large corporations, sort of the privatization on the just do it model, you know, how do you keep this going? It's impossible to have liquid corporate securities significantly outperform the GNP forever.
Well, I'm just thinking about the financial corporations, and I never did find that chart I talked to you about. But they profits of financial corporations as a percent of all corporations. Back in the 50s, for years and years and years, it was 5 to 8% of all corporate profits. Well, that jumped to about 30% back in the late 90s.
Right.
So what are they doing now that they didn't do before that they're being paid for? And I would suggest that it's nothing but useless trading. I mean, I can't.
Well, but you know, so you financialize healthcare. I mean, we don't need healthcare insurance. We just need healthcare. And turning it into an insurance product complexifies and makes it more expensive. So it's a complete waste of money, you know, to make it, to turn it into a financial product. So we keep financializing things, and the other is centralizing. One of my big concerns, I don't know if you saw the announcement about 6 weeks ago, Goldman announced doing an online lending business. Now, when Goldman Sachs goes back into retail to find markets, I get nervous. So I started to investigate, well, what's going on? Well, if you look at, you know, if you look at Bitcoin and blockchain, they're currently not scalable. Mm-hmm. But if you talk with the software developers who believe that they can innovate their way into scalability and make that scalability economic, it's a lot of ifs. You know, what the vision that they have will basically delete 8,500 community and local banks and 5,000 local credit unions. And if you delete them and make them uneconomic, then who's going to be left standing? It's the banks that have the force of the U.S. government and the Fed and use the bailouts to radically increase their market share. You know, they will still have control of the government credit and the government flows if nothing changes. And so, you know, with those going away, the question is who's going to do the lending? Well, that's when an online lending business could be attractive.
Right. Well, this is all part of the same trend of centralization and facelessness.
Right, right.
And I say facelessness because I think that makes a difference, you know.
Oh, yeah.
You know, I try to tell people want to buy gold or silver, and they ask me, well, why should I buy from you instead of Joe Blow discounter on the internet? I said, well, go on, buy from the internet. Because
right.
What you're going to do is you're going to do business with a computer. And nobody's
right.
going to ask you anything about your situation and find out what you really need.
Right.
So, and with a bank, it's just worse. You know, I mean, it's just much, that problem is just compounded if there's no human face at the bank that you can deal with.
Well, but I want to differentiate between banks, because there's a whole world, you know, I love my bank. I have the world's greatest bank. So I'm running around Europe and somebody hits my debit card with a $500 charge at Paris Disneyland. Within an hour, the bank is calling me in the middle of Europe. You know, I'm running around listening to music at concerts and says, one thing we know is you're not at Disney World. Even in Paris. So, you know, and we got it shut down, but it's because I have a human relationship with humans, and those humans do a fabulous job circulating liquidity in their local community and keeping things decentralized. Now, I'm not saying that the Federal Reserve System is perfect, because they've got to be a member of that whole thing, but if you wipe out all the little banks, you know, it's funny, what I keep hearing from people is I hate the banks, and my attitude is, wait a minute, you hate the New York Fed member banks who engineered all of this. Do you really hate the bank that's facilitating liquidity and stopping the crazy stuff in your neighborhood? Do you really, is that what you want, to destroy them?
Well, I couldn't agree more, but those are the banks that are being gobbled up. You know, if you look at the,
right,
going into the Great Depression, there were 15,000 banks. Coming out of,
right,
the Great Depression, there were about 8,000,
7,500.
Right. So half of them went down. And the,
right,
half that went down weren't big ones, weren't the biggest ones.
Right.
They were the small country banks, the local banks. And then, I don't know what we came out of the savings and loan crisis with, but probably 4,000 banks or less or fewer. And then there's been another shakeout after 2008. So what you've got is this process of centralization that's accelerating. And that means that those people have a stranglehold over the rest of us.
Right.
I mean, unavoidably, that's what that means. So, I guess Goldman Sachs sees that they want to jump into that market because they think it's going to be a growth market, but it's still scary.
Well, I'll tell you, at the end of the Great Depression, I'm glad you brought this up, there were 3,100 local currencies in America.
Really?
Yeah. And there was a giant sucking sound. You know, I think one of the reasons they did the WPA was you had syndicates coming together, doing their own currencies and building their own entrepreneurial networks. Father Divine had, I don't know, thousands of businesses going.
Mm-hmm.
And so they came in because what was happening is, you know, you were building syndicates of equity ownership away from the central channel. And it was getting powerful. People were learning how to do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you come in with lots of government money in the WPA and you keep things centrally controlled. But I think I've been reading about what's happening in the Caribbean and in Puerto Rico because of the decimation. You know, the electricity won't work, so the ATMs won't work. Clearly, your Bitcoin won't work. And that's exactly when you either need to know how to do local currencies, you know, to create them out of thin air and trade dollars or trade hours, you know, trade time or, you know, whatever. But if you have your gold and silver, you can just pull that out and start trading.
Right. And there was an article this morning about a shortage of cash in Puerto Rico. So,
right.
Which underlines what you just said.
Well, I know you've done a lot of work on trying to get gold and silver tradable.
Mm-hmm.
And you designed all the mathematics for the silver and gold calculator that we have up on the internet.
Right.
Not that it would be working when the electricity went down, but it'll teach you the concept. And you've also worked with a Tennessee state legislator to try and remove the taxes because, of course, in some states, the taxes are a problem. But if you go around the country and you follow this in the Money Changer, states are either doing or talking about depositories, and it looks to me like they're getting prepared to be able to trade gold and silver if the dollar goes away.
Well, that's exactly what the Texas depositories are planned for.
Right.
Yeah. And they finally somebody, some contractor stepped up and said he'd do it.
Right.
You know, he'd implement the plan.
So, that's courageous,
you know,
man.
This is the, no, they are courageous. This is a, You know, this is one of the big objections that I have to Bitcoin is you own it, but if you can't access it, what good does it do you?
Right.
So, I mean, we had this problem this morning. I'm supposed to be on your show, and my power goes out.
Right.
And I can't do anything. I haven't got internet. I haven't got telephone. I haven't got anything. So it doesn't happen all the time, but it certainly happens enough that you have to take it into account.
Well, our third quarter wrap-up is called Control 101.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things that has really struck me, and, you know, I kind of feel like I'm in many situations where I get to play Franklin Sanders, but I keep telling people, look, control is analog. The control system ultimately works out of, you know, out of the barrel of a gun.
Uh-huh.
It works through physical force. Now, there are many, many layers because you can stay a lot more invisible and a lot more secret if you don't come out of the closet and use physical force. So, you know, the control system, and it's grown over centuries, is very complex, and, you know, they like not to be caught visibly using physical force, although they do it all the time. But control is analog. It's and thinking that you can create a digital system, so this is the way I say it, our governance system is secret and doesn't have integrity. Our financial system, which is a subset of the governance system, is also sort of secretive and doesn't have integrity. And now we have information systems that don't have integrity. And even if they did, they depend on electricity, which more and more doesn't have integrity. So why do you think you can create a financial digital product and it's going to create integrity?
You're carrying collards to Georgia here, or colds
right,
to Newcastle, or whatever it is, because I couldn't agree with you more.
Well, but I think I almost feel when I talk with folks about this that they're, you know, sort of in the bubble of living in a world where they had they enjoyed constitutional rights and they haven't gotten hit by the smite button yet. And they really don't understand that the world is controlled physically and it doesn't have integrity for a reason. And that reason is, you know, we're being harvested. So
there,
and they,
you know,
don't.
There are a lot of people who call themselves libertarian who think that way and get a lot of publicity. You know, they're very public. They publish, they write newsletters, that kind of stuff. And the fact is, you don't get the whole picture unless you realize that we're being harvested, that somebody up there is trying to,
right,
is profiting off of all these things. And so, I mean, I understand their enthusiasm about Bitcoin, and I wish them well, and I hope that it does mark a new age of decentralization and elimination of intermediaries. But there are a lot of roadblocks in the way, and there are a lot of suspicions in my mind about who's in charge.
Right. Well, most of the smart people I've talked to, I have more research to do, but the smart people I talked to so far think there's a backdoor. And even if there's not a backdoor in the, you know, it's funny because I finally decided, because of interest of clients and subscribers, you know, I've just got to due diligence this stuff.
Uh-huh.
And Franklin, I've spent over 100 hours trying to understand blockchain technology. And I do think open distributed ledger technology has a lot of potential. So, but I've spent about 100 hours. And at the end of 100 hours, I still couldn't tell you, you know, how to theoretically invest in Bitcoin securely. So I have one more appointment of somebody who I think can really help me. But it's all based on four secret decoder rings. And what I have to tell you is, somebody with my history and experience can't give you a definitive picture of this thing after 100 hours. And after talking to lots of experts and, you know, finding really the best, I think, some of the best materials on this stuff, then there's a problem.
Yeah. Well, you know, one thing, too, I'd like to add to that is a lot of times well-known public figures, let's say Warren Buffett, for instance, will make statements that are very positive about some investment or the other. And people don't think, it doesn't occur to people that they may be talking their book. You
right.
know what the
exactly.
phrase talking your book means. It means
yeah.
you're talking up investments you already own so that other people will buy them and drive them up further. So I think whenever you see these, you know, announcements, positive or negative, like Jamie Dimon came out and slammed Bitcoin not long ago.
And then the J.P. Morgan traders picked it up cheap.
yeah, right. I mean, exactly. You know,
right.
They have some advantage doing that. They have some advantage.
Right.
Just like Warren Buffett saying the other day that the stock market by 2100 would be a million, would be over a million. The Dow would be over a million. Well, you know, they always, the establishment always trots out Buffett whenever they've got a crisis on their hands or a crash in the stock market. You know, they always trot him out, and he says basically what J.P. Morgan said in 1907, the country is basically sound and nobody ever made money going short on America or something like that.
Right.
But it's they're talking their book. You know,
right.
it's all propaganda. So
right.
you got to be careful about that. I'm with you. I've not studied Bitcoin, but that chart just makes me so nervous. I can't buy it.
Well, let me just say, because what Bitcoin right now is a speculative investment.
Yeah.
But let me tell you a story. I was in Germany, went to Basel to do a great interview with Thomas Meyer, and whose publishing company is based in Basel. And then I drove with Thomas past the Bank of International Settlements to the Basel Railroad
I know
station.
Exactly where that is.
Right. And so I walk in and I go to the automated machine to buy my ticket. And it turns out, you know, so I'm less than a mile away from the BIS. I think it's about a mile. And I buy my ticket and I can pay with Bitcoin. But get this. Not only can I pay with Bitcoin, but I can buy more Bitcoin. I can top up my Bitcoin wallet from the Swiss Federal Railway automated machine. And meantime, I'm having a war with a software developer on email about Bitcoin and Ethereum, and he's saying this is a grassroots revolution. And I'm saying, if I'm buying a Swiss Federal Railway ticket next to the BIS in Basel, Switzerland, surrounded by all the pharmaceutical companies, how can this be a grassroots phenomenon?
Well, isn't that a good question?
Yeah, that was pretty interesting to me. So, I really, you know, I believe this is prototyping, and you know, you and I, one of the things I showed at the conference was that speech by Aaron Rousseau that I love, or the interview with Alex Jones where Rousseau explains that the Rockefellers told them that their goal ultimately was to get people chipped, and then you could. You know, if they didn't behave, you could turn off their chip and they would starve and, you know, no cash and everything would be done with digital currencies. And if you wanted to raise taxes, you just took it out of their chip. And there it was. And, you know, to me, if Aaron Rousseau said it, it happened. And I, you know, I believe. I told you I did some reading on the African slave trade. I found it's a great professor from Cornell who wrote a book called The Half Has Never Been Told about the fundamental economics of slavery. And one of the things he described, or my interpretation from reading his history and the real economics, is there are two reasons that they canceled the slave trade. One was they couldn't put down the Haiti Revolution, and the Haitians managed to beat several European armies. And that scared them, because if that then moved virally through the American South, it would be very hard to deal with. So one was that, but the other was you couldn't perfect collateral, and the Southern plantation owners kept selling the slaves west when commodity prices were down and defaulting on their debt. And then the banking system, you know, so it was the Southern banks who couldn't figure out how to find the collateral, and you know, and Wall Street, who was selling income-producing securities off of all this. And the banks in London were losing money, and it kept happening. But now with digital technology, you can perfect collateral. It solves one problem.
When you say perfect collateral, you mean you can establish your title to those people?
Right. So once I put a chip in you, you know, that is GIS trackable, I can find you anywhere in the world at low cost.
Right.
And I can prove that you're related to that loan. So suddenly I have a highly economic manner of perfecting collateral.
Well, this is one thing about slavery that people don't understand. If the actual legal theory of slavery in the chattel slavery in the United States was not that you owned the person, you owned their labor. So
right.
If you paid $1,000 for a slave, what the way that you would financially calculate the value of that slave is you would amortize the future value of his labor and discount it back to the present.
Right.
So you know how all that's done. It's done with any investment. Well, people don't realize that when you get a student loan, you are monetizing
right.
your future labor. You are
right.
You're selling that future labor forward
right.
to somebody, and the bank owns it. And it is not an accident that in 2005 they ended bankruptcy against student loans.
Right.
Now, they let the slaves run around free, but if they've got them chipped and where they can locate them, then they're not really free. They're just it's just easier. You don't have to pay for their upkeep, is what it amounts
to. You know,
to.
I don't know if you ever read it. I wrote an article called William Diefender for the Hitman of Student Loans about the guy who I believe engineered all of that and who used to be a former board member of mine. And to me, one of the biggest questions, the most important questions in America is why would someone like William Diefenderfer do that? Why would you destroy the future of millions of kids? Why would you sit down with a piece of paper and a pen and figure out to destroy the future of not only the kids, but the country? Because when you destroy the future of the young people, you destroy the future of the country.
Right.
Right. Very sobering.
Can't
thought.
Figure out why he did it?
No, I can't figure out. What the question I ask is, why did he do it, and why does his family go along with him doing it? And how do you walk through the world feeling good about yourself having done that? Now, that's a question I've explored a lot, because what I wanted to understand was not just the corruption of the swamp, but the corruption of the general population. Because, you know, one of the trances, there are a couple trances in America. One trance is that we don't appreciate the extent to which the leadership believes in slavery, practice slavery, and how phenomenally profitable it is. I mean, slavery, I would argue that slavery is the most profitable business in the history of human civilization, and that would include war, because you can't implement, it's very difficult to implement war without slavery. You know, you've got to get people, you've got to be able to force people to do all sorts of things.
Well, I'm sitting here thinking about what it was that Goethe said, that nobody is so firmly enslaved as the person who thinks that he's free.
Right. Right.
And if you talk this sort of stuff, if you try to explain this to Americans, they become irate, because it couldn't possibly be so. It couldn't. This is the home of the brave and the land of the free, and it always has been, right? But
well, that gets me. One of the things I wanted to bring up today was Charlottesville.
Yeah.
Because when Charlottesville really exploded, I think I was in Europe, so, and I really wasn't in a position to give you a call, and because all I could think about was, you know, I hope Franklin, I used to pray for you, I hope his faith is strong, because to know what you know.
Go ahead.
Well, to know what you know about Charlottesville, I mean, to the Civil War and the history of the country, and then to listen to the rhetoric on that. Now, frankly, I think Charlottesville was entirely an op, a professional operation, and it was all designed to create fake news. And what was amazing, I don't know if you've seen some of the interviews, even on CNN, I don't think the American people fell for it. But during that time, I would get messages from subscribers who were deeply depressed about the whole thing.
It was depressing.
Yeah, no, it's very depressing. It was very depressing, but you know, I sort of think both sides of that were pretty much financed and organized by, you know, call it Soros 3.0, whoever it is.
So whoever's doing it, yeah.
Yeah. So I just think it's like a reality TV show. I don't think it's real.
Yeah, and you were praying for me to make sure that the top of my head didn't blow off, right?
Well, I had a guy who used to be fairly senior in covert ops at the CIA tell me, he said, look, it's like a wave. You need to just let it roll over and ignore it. And, you know, when those kind of things happen, the most efficient way to use your time is to just completely ignore it and let it roll over and keep focused on what you're supposed to be doing. So, but it's what I call the shriek-o-meter. The shriek-o-meter is getting louder and louder. And what is scary to me, Franklin, is how many people are falling from it. I just saw a very attractive young woman give a whole speech about what was going on in America based on the theory that the kids showing up in the black hoods and doing the violence were citizens as opposed to paid professionals. She didn't know. And I thought, oh, my God, how can you not know?
She thinks people can leave their jobs, travel all the way across the country, 5, 6 hours, 10 hours, just to go get in a fight with other people that they're not paid.
Somebody had a picture of two buses and the neo-Nazis getting off one bus and the Black Lives Matter getting off the other bus. And it's like a group of actors just, you know, reporting for work.
Well, you know, I think one of the funny things about all this is this Nazi phobia. You know, Nazism is the American elite's ideology. They are fascists to the core. I mean,
right.
The same thing. It's corporatism. It's
right.
It's what Mussolini really pioneered. So there's an irony there. But the other irony is that the arm-waving, flag-waving Nazi ideology has zero chance of taking root in the United States. Absolutely
right.
Zero. I mean, it's like worrying about the whole world being taken over by Johnson grass. It's annoying. It's an annoyance, but it's not a real threat, you know.
I mean, right.
Serious people don't worry about that being a real threat. And
they
keep playing this tune, like, I mean, over and over and over. And what I think one of the things that grieves me the most is the incredible lies that are being told in the name of undoing or fighting racism, and they're nothing but racism personified.
Right.
And the whole purpose of this is to divide us one from the other. So
right.
whatever progress has been made in the last 60 years in terms of racial harmony is being destroyed now. And
right, and what I see from being in most popular, you know, when I'm around, when I dive into, and I was in Walmart the other night, I got home late from Colorado and stopped on the way at one of the super centers on the way home, and I think I was one of the few white people, and, you know, you feel the hostility. They don't understand. Now, if you look at the squeeze they're taking on their incomes and everything else, they're in a brutal squeeze. Everybody is, but they are especially. So, but they,
that's true,
they don't see the game. Right.
Yeah, and that's what, I mean, you know, and it's different in different parts of the country, but Memphis is a hotbed, and you're over in that area. I mean,
right.
Area is the hotbed of that racial antipathy, and it makes it very, very uncomfortable and unpleasant to be there, because that sort of, that has taken over and sort of rules everything. I'm not saying it has to. I'm just saying it is. And all of this business about monuments is just making the problem way, way worse than it ever has been. And
it's funny. I wrote a long commentary on my website about, you know, because I grew up in an African American neighborhood. I was raised by an African American woman, and then you know, both Wall Street and my life, I've had lots of dealings, or, you know, and then when I studied spiritual warfare, I studied in an African-American church. For a long time, my best friend was African-American. Georgie was African-American. And so I've listened to the concerns and the legitimate and illegitimate complaints of the African-American community for a long time. And, you know, if you read Dylan Reed and the Aristocracy of Stock Profits, that was, you know, part of what the reason I did what I did was they were committing genocide in African-American neighborhoods, and I was trying to stop it. So, yeah. the drugs, the weapons, the whole game, and then the private prison. So these guys, and it was really funny, Franklin, this is how naive I was. In the 90s, I thought they were just going to kill all the African-Americans and maybe some of the Hispanics, because in 1994, one of the deputy assistant secretaries in the Clinton administration said to me, "Look, black people are hopeless. We're going to clean them out and bring in the Hispanics." You know, so that it was a plan. And, you know, sometime if you're interested, I can talk about it in more detail. But, you know, so I thought the genocide was just the African-Americans. I didn't realize it was everybody.
Oh yeah, no. It's everybody because they.
It's everybody, right?
You're all what the Nazis used to call nutzlose Fresser, useless eaters. That's
yeah.
all you are. That's just the way they look at all of us. So yeah, I understand what you're saying and how that fits together. But what's happening right now is a maximum divide and conquer effort.
Right.
Maximum divide and conquer effort.
Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I've always believed, there's tremendous knowledge in the African-American communities. One of the reasons I studied spiritual warfare at an African-American church was having grown up in those communities and seen the drugs and mortgage fraud come in when I was a child. I knew they had the knowledge and technology of how to outwit it, because I've seen them outwit it. And really, they go at things through the prism of spiritual warfare. That was, I don't know a lot about Martin Luther King, but I assume that was part of, you know, sort of how he did what he did, and Malcolm X too. So anyway, so I said, okay, they've got the technology on how to deal with these guys, you know, because it's completely lawless and very violent. And so how do you stand up against something that's all, you know, in a material sense, all powerful, completely lawless and very violent? Well, without spiritual tools, you're not going to make it. So off I went. And what's interesting is I know they have a lot of that technology that could help white people, but I've never been able to figure out, okay, how do you build the bridge between the people who really know that technology and practice it and middle-class white people who don't understand that it's there?
Yeah, they don't think it's going to be pointed against them, maybe.
It's being pointed against them every day now.
Oh, I know.
Yeah.
I understand that, but they don't think that it is. And
right.
So.
Right.
But the only thing I know to do, I mean, the only practical thing for me to do is to resist that at a personal level.
Right.
I'm just not going to take part in that at a personal level. I'm not going to lie and say that history didn't. What happened didn't happen. That history is way more complicated,
right?
And more intricate, and
right.
more. I guess the word is vexed than people think. You know, I mean, when you just think about the war between the states, people lived. White and black people lived together all the
right.
time. They rubbed
right.
shoulders all the time, and segregation didn't come into way after the war in the 1890s. When people live together all the time, they got to figure out some way to get along.
Right. They got to survive together economically.
Yeah.
Here's what I see when I look at this. You know, if you just look at an intergenerational pool of capital, the same intergenerational pool of capital is organizing the slave trade, selling the slave trade into the South, and then organizing covertly the Civil War, then outlawing slavery, so you do the dump, and then targeting, you know, everybody, and then coming along and saying, oh, well, you know. So they've been pumping the dumping and dividing the races, you know, for 150 years. And so if you look at the intergenerational pools of capital we're dealing with, it's the same guy who made all the money pumping and dumping the African slave trade.
Yes, absolutely.
Right. Right. It's, you know, so I
that's, the reason, That's the reason people in the South get so bumfuzzled and angry about
right.
people from New England getting up on their high horse since folks from about slavery, since folks from Rhode Island and Massachusetts were the ones who ran the slave trade. How do you think they built Brown University?
Oh, yeah.
That's
I know,
the money
it's,
came
it's
from.
Brown University's in the Dylan Reed story because they were, you know, if you look at the private prison, they were making money on that one, too.
Yeah.
So, I don't know if you realize they brought in this great African-American president to kind of cover up after they got outed on that one, and who ended up on Goldman Sachs' board. So, it never ends. So, one of the things I want to bring up, because I beat the drum all the time about Silicon Valley software and entrainment technology.
Uh-huh.
You know, I try and get all my subscribers to listen or read the we did a really great Celeria report on entrainment technology, because I find one of the problems folks have in understanding something like you know, all the different false flag events or all the different reality TV shows, a lot of it depends on entrainment technology to really make the marketing go. And you know, have you ever read that transcript?
I don't think I have.
Okay, I'm going to send it to you because I got to get everybody to read this, because it's definitely a piece. But one of the opportunities I've had in the last couple years is opportunities to meet with or see in person speeches by people who are at the top of the sort of software development food chain. So they're either running software businesses or they're investing and had a lot of success investing in software businesses, you know, on and on and on. And some of them are in person, some I'm watching videos. And what I'm watching is a group of people who are living in a little bubble. You know, they understand the pieces they're dealing with. They don't, like the rest of us, they don't necessarily have an integrated piece of the whole picture. So, for example, if you look at Silicon Valley, what you'll see is, okay, here's how much technology got engineered out of the black budget, you know, and dumped on Silicon Valley for free. And here's all the money that was gathered with the crack cocaine epidemic and other drugs into communities and invested, you know, at very low cost, you know, so you get a government subsidized cost of capital, you get government subsidized technology, then you have a boom with government continuing to pour in capital and you think you're a genius.
Yeah.
And you have nothing to do with government. Yours is a private business and you've made all this money and your success is from your own hard sweat. Not realizing, of course, that this technology is what the top guys want to help facilitate centralization. So you've got Mr. Global's wind at your back because you're basically doing his dirty work for him. But you don't know that. You think you're a genius. Right?
Right.
Right. Okay. So you're helping to centralize and you're on this tear. And anyway, so basically, in all sorts of different conversations, these folks think, I'm going to take software, and I can use software and artificial intelligence to run every business, government, and operation in America. Okay?
I'm sorry to laugh. I had to stop.
Right. Now, here's the thing. If you read, there's a wonderful new book that I recommend to you called Weapons of Math Destruction by Kathy O'Neill, who was a very successful academic, got hired to D.E. Shaw to do analytics, and then became appalled at how software was being used and sort of the embedded algorithms in these different businesses that were using to facilitate, you know, sort of consolidating various markets. And one of the things she shows is how you can get a software algorithm that helps centralize, helps really harm or destroy some people, and everybody thinks that it works because they can get away with it.
Right.
You know, you're doing things that ultimately are lawless, and if they're not illegal, they should be. So, but, and you're also playing with a lot of government money, whether it's directly or indirectly. So if you look at the, you know, if you look at the whole ecosystem of what's going on, you're shrinking the total economy, but you think you're a genius because it's making you money or somebody's paying you to do it or it works. It would never work unless Mr. Global wanted centralization and didn't care that it shrunk the pie or killed people. Anyway, so she does a pretty good job of sort of documenting the dynamic. And through her documentation, you realize how the people doing this, how, remember how I always say people who play in a rigged game get stupid?
Yes.
You've got incredibly wealthy, highly financially successful people who are getting a lot of admiration and attention, you know, because that's always how Mr. Global does you. You know, and they think they're enormously successful and this is all a great plan and it's all going to work. And what they'll tell you is, oh, well, we'll just give people universal basic incomes. You've seen Zuckerberg come out for universal basic incomes, right? And they really think the money that they have is their money, not understanding, you know, ultimately control is analog. So, you know, when Mr. Global wants them to invest all that money in, you know, whatever, that's what they're going to have to do, or goodbye to them.
Well, you know, the ultimate conclusion of their reasoning is that we can just do away with the human beings and have artificial intelligence.
Right.
And I mean, whenever you take anything to its ridiculous extreme, that tells you whether the argument is correct or not. So it can't be correct. I don't know if you've read Flash Boys by Michael Lewis, but it what that covers is the HFT revolution on Wall Street. And basically what these people figured out a way to do was to put a $22 billion a year tax on the stock market.
Right.
By useless, completely useless trading. Does
right.
nothing whatsoever to make the market more efficient.
Right.
And somehow it just keeps going on. It just keeps going on. And these are the people who are, you know, that's who's running Wall Street. That's who's, and then they, of course, they can take a lot of that money and increase their leverage in Washington with it. So
there's one other thing I wanted to bring up to you, and that is when I was in Colorado, I had the opportunity to see the documentary Dark Web and meet Lynn Ulbricht, who is Ross Ulbricht's mother. Ross Ulbricht was the technologist who was indicted and prosecuted by the federal government over the Silk Road website.
Mm-hmm.
And his sentencing involved, I think, two consecutive life sentences plus 40 years. It's quite... and it's a highly, you know, it's like my story or your story. It's unbelievably complicated.
Mm-hmm.
And thanks to Lynn's speech and thanks to the documentary, I was able to sort of basically get the timeline. But I also saw a TED speech by one of the prosecutors who prosecuted the case. And I'm going to grossly oversimplify and come back to a point I want to make, because you and I share some pretty unique knowledge about sort of legal enforcement in the United States. The prosecutor's presentation basically said, look, we had a task force underneath the jurisdiction of the FBI, and two of the agents decided to steal $25 million of Bitcoin, which is now worth a fantastic amount of money. And so they engineered a theft and were able to persuade one of the admins of the site that another person involved in the site had stolen it, not them. And then they claimed to have persuaded the one of the admins to pay them to murder the guy that they were framing for stealing the Bitcoin that they had stolen. Now, remember, these are federal agents. So number one, they steal. Number two, they do a criminal entrapment. Number three, they then persuade somebody to commit a, you know, murder, they say, and then they falsify the murders, you know, and we go on for there. So here's a situation where a significant amount of any crime going on is being invented and created by the federal agents. And then they prosecute it, and then they brag about it. You watch the and she doesn't even know to be embarrassed about what she's saying. And, you know, when it's all said and done, they keep the Bitcoin.
Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah,
yeah, right.
Like when they seize the money, when they seize the cash, they keep it. They go buy something with it for themselves.
Right. So let me step back for a second and go back to my experience with some of these folks. So we had had our building seized, and they basically seized our software. In a process where we were required to turn over 100%. I was literally not allowed to keep my address book. 100% of any record or knowledge I had to turn in for, you know, and they were in control of our office for a week, and anything I had in my home I had to bring back. And, you know, it's a long and very interesting story, but one of the things that happened was when I came back into the building, which had been impeccable, it was designed after a Japanese tea house, and it was unbelievably pristine and clean at all times. It was a mess. They had literally done number ones and number twos on the rug.
Wow.
They had you know, put out cigarette butts in the rugs. They had left food and sort of ground it into the rugs and the floor. And the place, I mean, it was just, and it was energetically demonic, and it was designed to do this. It's designed to break your spirit. So I called in a team of sort of my dearest friends who have a cleaning company, and they brought a whole crew down. This crew was from both Washington and New York. And we spent 3 days, they spent 3 days just cleaning, and it was my personal expense because everything for the company was gone or frozen. So we cleaned and cleaned and cleaned because I just couldn't leave it that way. You know, I couldn't let that be on me. So on Monday, the property manager came in and he said to the guy I had running the facilities, he was so touched. He was basically a refugee who'd left Latin America because of the violence. So, you know, he had left South America to get away from this. And now, of course, here it was. And so he was so touched because he thought he was going to have to clean the whole thing up. He said to my facilities manager, while I was in the building, they organized and falsified a frame. Tell Austin to bring her attorneys and I will give you an affidavit, which is an incredibly courageous thing for the guy to do.
Oh, yeah.
And he gave an affidavit and he explained how they had taken empty shredding bins in the basement, gotten trash that we were saving. We weren't throwing the trash out because there was, you know, we were worried that they would say it was in violation of subpoenas.
Yeah.
They opened the trash, put it in the bin, and then went upstairs, got our accounting documents and pulled them out and put them on top of the shredding bins. And then the HUD IG general counsel started taking pictures. And they used him to get down in the basement, and he was watching, and he said to the general counsel, wait a minute, you can't do that. And she turned to him and she said, shut up, this is none of your business. So he gave us an affidavit describing all of that, and if he hadn't, I would have probably ended up in prison. But the other thing that happened is when they pulled out of the building, we knew to go in that night and get out the main servers. Now, they had backed everything up and had copies of everything, but we went in that night and got out the back servers and moved them over to our law firm so that they couldn't seize them. So they're behind the protection of attorney-client privilege, and my corporation owns them. There's nothing they can do. So the next morning we come into the office, the facilities manager goes in the office, and FBI and HUD IG team come back in, and one says to, I think it was HUD IG, who's working for this general counsel clearly or coordinating with him, says to my facility manager, and he freezes and just like freaks and says, where are the main servers? And facilities manager says, we took them last night. You know, we came in literally at midnight and took them. And he froze and he said, you don't understand, you can't take them. You can't do that. And the facilities manager says, we own them. You know, they're our property. And there's nothing you can do. They're gone. And the guy says, he turns bright red. He turned white. He said, you don't understand. I'm on strict orders. You're not allowed to have a copy of any of the knowledge.
Ooh.
And what I realized was, listening to the dark web, it appears in the dark, you know, what the people who were framed say, what Russ Albrecht and his attorneys and his family say is they falsified evidence from the digital systems, which they had control of. And I've always believed that the reason he was under orders, I may not allow you to have a copy of the knowledge, is one, we had copies of the mortgage databases, you know, the FHA mortgage databases that would show massive fraud, including securities fraud, if you understood what was going on. So you didn't want us to have that during the housing bubble. And the second thing was that I think they wanted to frame us using, you know, digital systems. So, which is to say, whether you look at the dark web case, my case, your case, I come back to you, our subscribers, whether it's the Money Changer subscribers, Salary Report subscribers, you do not want to depend on these systems for your records.
Oh, no.
You need to have either physical copies or you need to have digital copies that are offline and inaccessible, including over an air gap. So if it's digital, it's got to be very secure. It's got to be redundant in lots of different places. And, you know, physical likewise, you need redundancy and you need security. And these systems are not secure.
Well, precisely. So, you know, right. It's just like their ability to forge photographs now.
Right.
You know, they can Photoshop you in as the guy behind President Lincoln with a gun if they want to. And present that as evidence, and then if the judge lets it in, you're just sunk. And that's what happens, the judge does let it in. So, yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. But that isn't coming back around, isn't this another argument against Bitcoin?
Well, I think Bitcoin is first and foremost an op. Mm-hmm. You know, what Mr. Global wants is digital currencies.
Right.
And to get things cashless. So I think Aaron Rizzo is exactly right. He wants a chip and then digital currencies. Now, I should also say, there are absolutely legitimate reasons why the world also wants both local and digital currencies. So I think in a world that was free, you know, you and I would be dealing with local currencies and then we'd have cryptocurrencies and, you know, it would be very dynamic and robust.
Right.
So, part of that is, you know I certainly do. The world wants to be able to make low cost, speedy international transactions. Going through the banks is very cumbersome and you know, sort of frustrating, especially if you're used to click. And they want to be able to do it at very low cost. If you look at the current financial system, the fees and transaction fees are way too high if we're going to bring in everybody. So, you know, a farmer in India cannot afford these kind of transaction costs. He just can't. So there's a deep, deep hunger in the body politic to create better and speedier ways to transact with each other. And that's very real and positive. You know, the other thing when it comes to blockchain technology, Franklin, you know, there's a tremendous amount of optimization that can be done in businesses that will just cut the financial guys out. So you talked about the financial guys going to 30% or more, you know, of the GNP. You know, we could get that back down to 10%, and this kind of technology should help do it. So there's some very powerful fundamental economic reasons for the push, not just Mr. Global wanting to centralize. Anyway, so where was I? I went off on a tangent. But I think, you know, to me, blockchain is a prototype where you get all the creative guys who know software and this kind of hardware to prototype your digital currency. And so it's that period of innovation. I think I mentioned it. There's a great book by Tim Wu called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. And what it describes for the last 150, 200 years is an innovation comes out. We have them blossoming. Everybody thinks it's terrific. It's going to save the world. And then wham, after it gets figured out, it centralizes. And it happens again and again and again and again. So I think we're in the blossoming period. And, you know, so Mr. Global is figuring out how to do his digital currencies. And we're all helping him prototype. And if you look at what's being done to encourage people to do that, you know, one of the ways you do that, and you've seen this many, many times as this eye, is you pump and dump. So you run the price up, and suddenly everybody is getting squeezed, and the slow burn comes running in to make money.
Right.
Right. And if you have a huge position, then as long as you get your money out in the pump, not only do you get everybody to prototype your digital currency, but you make money doing it. It's quite remarkable.
Right. And you're pioneering the market too. They're pioneering the market for you.
Right. So they're pioneering the market. And meantime, you can buy the gold land without the prices running up anywhere near as much as they would if, you know, if all these people were buying coins.
Right.
I think it's, I mean, you have to give them credit. It's pretty clever.
Yeah, it is clever. But, you know, the problem from their standpoint and the optimistic outlook from our standpoint is that this technology keeps bubbling up, and the implication of it is decentralizing. And, you know, we've talked before about the era of centralization that ran from about 1650 till the downfall of the Soviet Empire. There was a tendency to centralize in human affairs, and it broke. It topped when there was only one world empire left standing, the American Empire. Now, I understand it's so strong now and has been for the last 25 years that everyone thinks, oh, that's not possible. You can't see it. But I want you to look at around the world. Look at what's happening in Catalan. Look at what's happening in Kurdistan.
Right.
Look at what has happened in Scotland. Look at all of these nations that are breaking away or want to break away, and they're ancient nations. I mean, Catalan's been there for 1,000 years.
Right.
They're ancient nations, and now in Germany, the same decentralizing tendency that helped bring Trump to power and helped swing the vote for Brexit. That same decentralizing tendency has worked out in Germany as well. So there's a decentralizing tendency in human affairs that has taken over and is going to run the next 400 years or so. And that makes me very optimistic. Now, there can be a lot of messiness and bloodshed in the meantime while that gets sorted out, you know, because as Stalin said, the ruling classes never voluntarily leave the stage of history. That's very much true. But their days are numbered. Their days are numbered. Because loyalty is shifting away from central points back to peripheries.
Right.
And that tendency, that trend is going to go on for 400 years, and it's going to speed up. And it just astounds me, you know, when I look at the news, at least once or twice a week, there's some big decentralization taking place somewhere.
So the last thing I wanted to bring up was the U.S. Constitution, because I think one of the things I've seen is I think Bitcoin is also a laundry for a variety of things. But I watched a presentation this weekend of someone who is running. They say they're running for president, but the campaign is running for not president. And here's the plan they propose. And I would tell you they're being financed by Bitcoin anonymously.
Mm.
So they don't, you know, if I run for Congress, I've got to disclose everybody who gives me money. Or if I'm a not-for-profit or a lobbyist, I got to disclose who gives me money.
Mm-hmm.
But these guys are doing this, you know, and they get their money from Bitcoin, so they don't have to disclose where they're getting the money, and they can also say they don't necessarily know where they're getting the money.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, because it's anonymous, it's online, etc. So here's the plan, and you've seen this plan before. This is a test to see if you remember where you saw this plan implemented. The first thing you do is you use digital technologies to implode the U.S. government. So first you implode the government. You get into office the first day, and you create a trust. But because you've imploded, all cash flows stop. Okay? Then you create a trust and you privatize all the assets after you stopped all the cash flows. Okay, so if 50% of the income in all neighborhoods comes directly or indirectly from the federal government, you know, 50% of the people in every county suddenly have all their income stopped. So you can imagine what that's going to do to market prices right before you start privatizing. So when you privatize, obviously the only people who have any money are people who've stolen all the money in the financial coup and are prepared and ready for this because they've been looking forward to it, licking their chops. So then you proceed to privatize things at a penny on the dollar, you know, all the national land, all the whatever. And so they buy up everything, you know, and then you go for there. And the Constitution is an old document. You don't need it. You just tear it up. And when questioned about how people are going to, you know, when this plan was tried in Russia, 25 million people is the estimate died, you know, because if you have no income and you have no savings, then you say you got 3 weeks of food and then you can live for another 3 weeks without dying. And so 6 weeks for, you know, the die off begins. And when I asked about that, they said, well, we need to learn to stop being materialistic. So you've seen this plan.
Stop eating?
Apparently. So you've seen this plan. But basically what they're saying is, you know, these guys got together and stole $27 trillion in the bailouts, $19 trillion in the missing money, more in the pump and dump of the housing market and the stock market, you know. And so what we're going to let them do is tear up the Constitution and abrogate all the obligations because there is no money. And then they buy everything at a penny on the dollar. And this is all being marketed as a way to get the bad guys back who did Iraq and to have, is to use this wonderful technology to, like, stop the evilness. And it's going to be so groovy because everybody's going to get what they want. I swear to you, I heard this presentation sitting in the main auditorium of the Aspen Institute.
Where is this coming from? From whom?
I'll send you the name of the guy who's running for president. He's an Iraqi vet, and it looks like he's got a group of vets now. Most of the people I was sitting next to were saying, "Wait a minute, this guy's not an activist. He's a pro." You know, this is a professional op. You know, this is an op. Now, I don't know the guy. So, but needless to say, I stood up and, you know, made a few very financially grounded suggestions. Because basically what he's saying, look, you know, let's go out and basically wipe out and destroy your family wealth and let Goldman Sachs buy your neighborhood at a penny on the dollar. And it was quite astonishing to watch. I'll send you the website so you can see it. But basically what you're trying to do, whether it's at the state legislature trying to get, oh, we need a constitutional convention, let's go in and revise the Constitution, which of course your good friend Edwin Vieira knows, you know, you open that door and the next thing they can do is tear it up. But if I've stolen $19 trillion out of the U.S. government illegally, and I don't want that, you know, for people now that the money is skinny to notice that and come and get that money back, because the legal mechanism exists, particularly under the Constitution, to go get that $19 trillion back. Wouldn't you want to shred it up? I mean, you're shredding up the trail.
Sure.
Right. So you're shredding up the paper trail and you're shredding up the legal trail. You know, you would want to shred that tail, the trail. So you've got one effort, you know, in the older generation going on to get a con, and then in the younger generation you've got another effort to say, oh, it's old, let's just blow it up.
Well, what, you know, one of the things that frightens me the most about that whole con thing is that if you have read anything the Founding Fathers wrote, or anybody from any American statesman of any stature from 1860 back, then you know that there is no one today, I don't care how many PhDs she's got, who has the intellectual grasp and integrity and breadth of vision to be able to devise a constitution.
Right.
I could make a lot of criticism of the U.S. Constitution, which essentially was a revolution to overthrow the revolution,
right.
And then was hijacked by Hamilton.
Right. Well, you and I disagree about that, but we'll discuss that another time.
Okay. But in any event, where are you going to get the experts today to devise a constitution? From Harvard, Yale, Washington? Where are they going to come from?
Well, if you had a constitutional convention, they're going to plop out what they've, you know, it's just like the Patriot Act. They're going to plop it out.
Oh, sure, it'll be what they've
got,
already prepared.
It's written, right. It's written, right.
Yeah.
Well, our second quarter wrap-up, the cover was a picture of George Washington with big pink lipstick on his cheek saying, if you don't enforce the Constitution, you can kiss your money goodbye. And I guess I've been through a period of great frustration so far this year.
Uh-huh.
And it's why we made the cover a little bit more catchy than we normally do. And that is this. I am constantly asked, Franklin, as I know you are, about where somebody should put their assets. Should we put it in coins? Should we put it in securities? Should we put it in bonds or stocks or this or Bitcoin or whatever? And the reality is, that's all very interesting and important. But if you shred the Constitution, it doesn't matter what your assets are in, because they're going to be gone. I mean, if somebody puts a chip in your arm and you can't buy food without a chip in your arm, then it doesn't matter.
Correct.
So
don't make a bit of it.
Right. So all financial systems, products, values, you know, trade on a platform of our covenants, whether cultural or legal. And I think because we've been so blessed as a society, most people have forgotten that. And if there is no law, then it doesn't matter what your assets are in, because the control will be affected analog.
Exactly.
Right.
Which is a very complicated way of saying somebody will stick a gun in your face and say, do it.
Right.
Yeah.
And, you know, the last time I saw that happen, most people went along. You and I were two of the, I don't know what our problem is, but we didn't seem to be able to go along. But here's one of the stories I told several times in the discussions I've had over the last week was you probably don't remember this. When the swine flu vaccine came out, I was very sure very early on that it was very dangerous.
Uh-huh.
So I wrote a blog post about, you know, this is depopulation, and took a lot of heat for it. But if you look at the medical practitioners, they came out hard and early, and there was so much opposition that they couldn't get it done, and they backed off. They were trying to go state to state to mandate it, and, you know, the uproar was... So they've come back sneaky, and then they put the swine flu in the flu vaccine, and, you know, it did a lot of damage. But needless to say, I was very clear this was my, you know, this was my moment, and I was not going to cross that line. And I called you and I said, Franklin, if it gets mandated here and it comes to that, can I bring my guns and come over to your house? And you said, yeah, I'm not taking it. So, you know, we're talking about a gunfight. And I said, okay. Because I was totally clear I was going to die in a gunfight if that was going to happen. You know, I wasn't going to run to Costa Rica. There's no point in running away. But that the moment had come where it was slave or freedom, and so I was probably going to die in a gunfight. And I would much rather kind of die in a gunfight with you than, you know, by myself. Do you remember that?
Yeah, I kind of do. Here's the thing. You have to draw that line in the sand before it happens.
Right.
Because if you don't, if you haven't made up your mind, this is the place I'm not going to go. This is the place
right.
I'm going to stop and fight. If you don't do that, then all you keep doing is saying to them, now don't you cross that line, and then stepping
right.
back when they cross
right.
it.
Well, I think the reason they backed off was they heard you know, thousands, if not millions, of telephone calls just like that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that, you know, that's one of the mistakes people make when they think about this sort of thing, is they don't realize that when the government comes out with these plans, or the elite, whoever they are, but it's usually enforced through the government, when they come out through it, there is such a thing as mass refusal to go along.
Right.
And they know that. That's the reason they mount such huge propaganda campaigns.
Well, I feel like we're coming into a inflection point, and it's going to be around the Constitution. So, because I agree with you, it's not perfect, but I have no interest in opening it up right now. First, we have to, you know, we have to decide, are we going to have a human society? Are we going to have an inhuman society? And if you look at the forces arrayed to tear up the Constitution, what they want is they want to keep the money they stole through the financial coup d'etat and use it to finance an inhuman society. And, you know, and there's going to be about 5 to 10% of us who decide if we are prepared to die in a gunfight to stop that. It may come down to that. But, you know, I would remind everybody there's many things we can do to make sure it doesn't come down to that. And one of them is shifting your money. So I had a subscriber post a really funny thing. They said, you know, I've been hearing you say this for years, but I just realized if we all moved our money out of the big banks, it would really shift things. It could be very powerful. And I said, wow, you know, sometimes it surprises me, how it takes things, how many years it takes to communicate things at a sort of emotional level.
Yeah, well, to go all the way from the eardrum to the brain and then to the heart takes a long distance.
Okay, well, before we close, Franklin, anything else you'd like to say about the next 3 months between now and the end of the year? Anything else?
Just that I think it's going to be very good for silver and gold.
Right.
I'm not expecting them to take off within the next 2 weeks, but I think it's going to be very, very good for silver and gold. And it appears it's shaping up to be bad for the stock market and bad for bonds. And, of course, it looks like interest rates are going to be rising, too. So all of that together signals a lot of turmoil, I think.
Right. And I think the one thing that people most appreciate you in our networks is you manage to turtle your way through enormous adversity, you know, or watching the Shriekometer on Charlottesville or things like this, and simply stay focused on, you know, doing good in this world and going forward. So you need to give us a last minute here on faith. How do you do it?
Oh, I'll share something with you that a friend of mine in Texas shared with me recently. And it has, you know, I hate the phrase, it's changed my life. But I will say I'm waking up thinking about it every single morning. She's summing up the fourth chapter of Philippians, the 4th through 7th verses. And what she says is this: my work today and every day is to rejoice always, to pray unceasingly, and to thank God in everything. Rejoice always, pray unceasingly, and thank God in everything. And that's my work every day.
Right.
And I have to tell you, I've known those verses for years. This is another example of the great distance between eardrum, brain, and heart. But I don't know why that has hit me so hard recently, Catherine, and it has taken a huge load off of me. It's taken away that irritability that comes in circumstances, you know, when things go wrong, when you stub your toe and then you break a thumb and, you know, everything's going wrong and fighting against you. And if I just keep thinking about that and keep it before me that my work today is to do those three things, it brings this, well, that's what the promise is, that the peace of God will guard your heart.
Right.
And it does, you know, it really does. But that's my discovery for the year. and I'm holding on to it.
Okay, well, Franklin, it's always a pleasure. You have a wonderful day. Thank you for joining us on the Soleri Report.
Oh, thank you for the opportunity. God bless you. Thank you. Bye-bye.